Before we move into the miracles question, I want to cite a pamphlet that I would strongly suggest you're obtaining. This pamphlet is entitled The Jehovah's Witnesses and Jesus Christ. The Jehovah's Witnesses and Jesus Christ, written by Bruce Metzger, a professor at Princeton Theological Seminary. M-E-T-Z-G-E-R, Bruce Metzger. Incidentally, it's important to have this pamphlet because after you've gotten back into the bathtub, the second time, the third time that the bell rings, it's a Jehovah's Witness with a record player. And you want to be able to give him this pamphlet and talk with him very rapidly because it's very cold standing there with only a towel on at the front door so that you can get back into the bathtub. All right. Now, we move into the question of the miraculous. If we knew ahead of time that miracles can't occur, then it wouldn't be necessary to spend any time on the historical evidences that we've been treating tonight. It wouldn't make any difference that the historical documents of the New Testament are tremendously good as documents. Wouldn't make any difference that they record miracles and principally the resurrection. Because if we knew ahead of time that miracles don't occur, there would have to be something the matter with these documents. And so we want to consider now the question as to whether there is any philosophical way of getting rid of the miraculous so as to eliminate the need for any historical presentation of them. The whole philosophical attempt to deal with the miraculous, and you should notice this, it's the most important thing to note, the whole philosophical attempt to deal with the miraculous is an attempt to eliminate the necessity of historical checking concerning the miraculous. The idea is to get a philosophical claw grip on the question, which will eliminate the necessity of any kind of historical examination of it. An attempt is made here to cut them off at the pass, to cut Christians off at the pass, to eliminate any reason for even checking to see whether miracles occur or not. And the question is whether such attempts are successful. The classic attempt along this line is the attempt of David Hume, the 18th century Scottish philosopher. It pains me to admit that Hume was Scottish. He is probably the only Scot to have done anything like this in the entire history of Scotland. It's a tragedy. It's the sort of thing that grips one on the deepest level that a Scotsman could actually have argued in this fashion. There's got to be some genetic difficulty there, but we won't attempt to analyze the problem on that level. What we want to do is to look at Hume's argument against the miraculous to see if it is a valid argument, because this is the argument that comes up again and again in different forms right up to the present. I agree that this argument ought to be in introductory philosophy texts. It should be. But it seems to me that it's generally misplaced. It's usually put in the religion section of the introductory philosophy text to show that you can't use miracles to argue for religious truth. Instead, it should be put in the logic section because it's a perfect example of circular reasoning. It will help the philosophy student to see how not to reason. So the argument does have permanent utility, but its utility is not in the area of philosophy of religion as much as it is in the area of logic. All right. Incidentally, when I had that encounter at the University of British Columbia, and we went around on the historical evidence for the miracles of Christ and for his deity, and the professor said, all right, I'll give up my knowledge of the classical world and so forth, after all of this ended, we had a continuing discussion in the professor's office. This was Professor Avram Stroll, who is now head of the philosophy department at University of California at San Diego, incidentally, who was at the University of British Columbia at the time this occurred. And finally, Professor Stroll said, as a matter of fact, I don't care what the historical evidence is because miracles just don't occur. And I said, well, wouldn't it have been better, Professor Stroll, if you had simply asserted this to the audience, and we could have saved so much time, because then they would have realized that you have a special pipeline to the center and circumference of the universe, and you know what can occur and what cannot, whereas other people are limited in their knowledge of such matters and cannot make such assertions. And on this basis, the audience would understand that your rejection of Christianity is due to Gnostic mysticism and hasn't got anything to do with facts whatever. The other members of the philosophy department were there on the occasion, and they sat back there and listened to this with very close attention. But the general public who were there didn't hear this. All right. What is Hume's argument? I will read it. This is from the Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding. A miracle, says Hume, is a violation of the laws of nature, and as a firm and unalterable experience has established these laws, the proof against a miracle from the very nature of the fact is as entire as any argument from experience can possibly be imagined. Why is it more than probable that all men must die, that lead cannot of itself remain suspended in the air, that fire consumes wood and is extinguished by water, unless it be that these events are found agreeable to the laws of nature, and there is required a violation of these laws, in other words, a miracle, to prevent them? Nothing is esteemed a miracle if it ever happens in the common course of nature. It is no miracle that a man, seemingly in good health, should die on a sudden, because such a kind of death, though more unusual than any other, has yet been frequently observed to happen. But it is a miracle that a dead man should come to life, because that has never been observed in any country. Footnote, very interesting, very interesting. Back to the text. There must, therefore, be a uniform experience against every miraculous event. Otherwise, the event would not merit that appellation. And as a uniform experience amounts to a proof, there is here a direct and full proof from the nature of the fact against the existence of any miracle. Nor can such a proof be destroyed, or the miracle rendered incredible, by an opposite proof which is superior. And then we come to the famous maxim of Hume. The plain consequence is that no testimony is sufficient to establish a miracle, unless the testimony be of such a kind that its falsehood would be more miraculous than the fact which it endeavors to establish. And even in that case, there is a mutual destruction of arguments, and the superior only gives us an assurance suitable to that degree of force which remains after deducting the inferior. He illustrates this. Now, when anyone tells me that he saw a dead man restored to life, I immediately consider with myself whether it be more probable that this person should either deceive or be deceived, or the fact which he relates should really have happened. I weigh the one miracle against the other, and according to the superiority which I discover, I pronounce my decision, and I always reject the greater miracle. If the falsehood of his testimony would be more miraculous than the event which he relates, then and not till then can he pretend to command my belief or opinion. All right, what's going on here? Hume says, any time any evidence comes up for the miraculous, you don't need to check it out. Why? Because it would be more miraculous if the person giving this evidence were actually telling the truth than it would be if the miracle occurred. Now, how does Hume know that it would be more miraculous for the person to be telling the truth? More miraculous that he wasn't mistaken or deceived or something of that kind? Answer, says Hume, because there is a firm and unalterable experience against miracles. In other words, there are natural laws against miracles. Where do natural laws come from? They come from firm and unalterable experience. Thus, when someone comes along and claims that a miracle has occurred, you don't have to get out of your armchair. You can relax. There's no sense in going through a lot of grubby old historical investigation to deal with a problem like that, because no matter what you check on, you will always find a situation where it would be more miraculous if the poor fellow were really telling the truth, since there is firm and unalterable experience against the miraculous. If there weren't firm and unalterable experience, then you wouldn't be able to talk about a miracle at all. I've tried to present this as persuasively as you can present an utterly illogical argument. And it takes a great deal of vim, vigor, and vitality at this hour of the evening to present a lame-brained argument in a seemingly persuasive fashion. What is the trouble with this? Well, the trouble, obviously, is that the only way you could know if there was firm and unalterable experience against miracles would be to check out individual claims to the miraculous. Until you've checked them out, how could you possibly know that the experience is uniform against them? You see, what Hume is saying is, premise, there is a firm and unalterable experience against miracles. Conclusion, miracles don't occur. Well, to be sure, if there is a firm and unalterable experience against miracles, miracles don't occur, because that simply says, if there are no miracles, there are no miracles. Something that gives you that same warm feeling that 2 plus 2 equaled 4 gave you at the very outset of this session. In other words, that is a tautological kind of statement. If you know what you mean by miracle, you've been given no additional information whatever in the assertion that if miracles don't occur, then miracles don't occur. What are natural laws, after all? Hume went beyond his own time in recognizing that natural laws are the product of experience. Natural laws don't drop down from heaven. You know, you don't look up and a plate drops down, sort of like the golden tablets from the angel Moroni. You don't look up and plates drop down, and the plates give you natural laws, which you then know to be the case under all circumstances. Natural laws, so-called, are nothing more than our generalizations from experience, right? We observe regularities, we conclude that laws are of a certain kind. There is Newton, he's sitting there, apple dislodges itself, it falls, bonk. Newton concludes that apples generally fall on philosophers' heads rather than philosophers' heads rising up to meet apples. In other words, after observing this sort of phenomenon with fair regularity, he states a general principle on the basis of it. But the principle is nothing more than the result of observations and generalizations. Hume is in advance of his time in seeing that. But he is also a creature of his time, because in the 18th century, people got hypnotized by their own natural laws. They thought that they were getting to know the universe like a English playing field, like a rugby field, in which all the rules were perfectly clear and patent. But as a matter of fact, they didn't have everything as tightly as that. But Hume, while admitting that natural laws are the product of experience, then simply asserts that there is always firm and unalterable experience for the laws. Obviously, you only know that if you check it out. In other words, let us say that you are an observer of the dead. You are a necrophile of some sort, and you observe dead people, and you find that in general, dead people stay dead. All right? This is like Newton noting the falling of apples on physicists' heads and so on. All right, you observe this, and you find a tremendous number of people dying and staying dead. It seems to be a very common sort of occurrence, not only in the present, but in the past. So, you state a general rule. People who die stay dead. But that may be the product of experience, yet it is not the product of firm and unalterable experience unless you have checked out any claims of people dying and not staying dead. And if you find that there is enough evidence for somebody dying and not staying dead, you can't shove it under the rug and pretend it isn't there just because most other people don't die and rise again. What you've got to do is to revise your general statement. Something like this. You want a natural law on the subject? Something like this. In general, people who die stay dead, footnote, with one very important exception. And the very important exception, of course, is Jesus Christ, based upon experience that, as a matter of fact, he didn't die and stay dead, but rose again from the dead. Since experience establishes the laws, experience also has got to be marshaled for exceptions. Here's another way to think about it. The true scientist, or the better scientist, does not get hypnotized by his own generalizations and refuse to check out exceptions. The good scientist is constantly analyzing particular cases to see if the particular cases go along with the general rule. Example. You all remember the periodic table. The periodic table was a reasonably successful attempt in the 19th century to classify the elements according to their combining properties. In the 19th century, the atomic theory was first set forth, and this was generally expressed in a kind of a physical model where the element is a kind of miniature solar system, and around its central nucleus go electrons. And in the outer electron ring, you have either available electrons that will snuggle up with other electrons to form chemical compounds, or you don't. Some elements have their outer electron rings just stuffed to their little gullets, and therefore they do not engage in such combination. Other elements have available electrons, and so chemical combinations take place. Incidentally, I think it's very interesting that this theory was developed in the late 19th century during the period of Romanticism. You see, you have here the elements attracting each other, a kind of a mutual romantic involvement among elements. It's very strange to me that no historians of science have attempted to correlate the development of the periodic table with Keats and Shelley. And so on. But of course, if you begin thinking this way, you feel very strange when you look into an electron microscope. You feel like a peeping Tom, basically. But be that as it may, the periodic table was developed, and along one margin of the periodic table, you get the so-called inert gases, or inert elements, krypton, argon, and stuff like that there. Now, these are the célibataires among the elements. These are the bachelors who do not combine according to the theory because their outer electron rings are already full. Now, of course, there aren't little balls going around. These are changes in energy level. But the idea is the same. All right, so there they are, and they're not supposed to combine. Okay? Now, it so happens that in the last 15 years, successful attempts have been made to combine the inert elements. Thus, we have this fascinating article. People have crushed each other to get this at the neighborhood libraries. This is entitled Xenon Hexafluoroplatinate by Neil Bartlett of the Department of Chemistry at the University of British Columbia. This is in the Proceedings of the Chemical Society for 1962. Or, if you'd like something even more thrilling, there is the article that appeared in American Scientist in 1963 entitled New Compounds of Noble Gases, the Fluorides of Xenon and Radon. The interesting thing is that these combinations were brought about by ordinary chemical means. They did not require some super sophisticated atomic techniques that were not available a long time ago. Why didn't people try? Answer, because of the elegance and aesthetic satisfaction that came from the periodic table. Everything was so neat, and it was so nice to have those inert elements all along one column of the periodic table. But the fact of the matter is that it was possible for compounds of these elements to come about. Suppose Hume, or a Humean view, had prevailed in these matters. There had been uniform experience against the combination of the inert elements. Huh? Uniform experience had established the structure of the periodic table, that is to say, a natural law. Thus, if somebody came along and said, I have managed to create xenon hexafluoroplatinate, The proper reply would be, would it be more miraculous that he really created this, or that he was deceived or had been deceived? Or would it be more miraculous that this actually came about? And always the conclusion would be that it would be more miraculous if he actually were telling the truth, because there is the uniform structural certainty of the periodic table. You see the logic of this? What we're saying is simply that experiment and observation and the checking of particulars has to precede and criticize generalizations. Nobody knows the universe so well that he can declare that there is absolute, uniform, and unalterable experience against anything. The universe is a very complex place. As that eminent philosopher of our time, Woody Allen, has said, you can't even find your way around in Chinatown. The universe poses all kinds of difficulties, and because it's so complex, you can't rule out events. You can only investigate the claims to events. And you can't pull a sort of variant on this, a statistical variant in which you say, ah, but the statistical pressure of all the regularities is so heavy that it outweighs the evidence over here for anything that goes against the regularities. Because such an assertion presumes that you can judge this by this. It's just another way of stating the same thing, namely that the weight of regularity is so gigantic that you never need to check anything out that goes against it. But my heavens, if that were put into action, it would destroy all scientific investigation and would cause human life to drop down to what is existent. Nothing new would ever arrive. You see, this argument is another one of those two-edged swords. If you use this argument outside of the religious realm, you suddenly discover that it destroys science, it destroys innovation, it forces you to an impossible conservatism that makes newness impossible. Thus, you have a choice. You either give this business up in both respects, or you continue to apply it in both respects, and your knowledge falls in. It is another application of our fundamental technique. Let me refer you to a fairly new book on the subject of miracles that is well worth looking at. This is done from a philosophical standpoint and is a remarkably good work on the subject. Richard Swinburne, The Concept of Miracle. That's Swinburne. Richard Swinburne, The Concept of Miracle. And that is published by Paper Mac. What in the sun is that? Just a moment here. No, I'm sorry. It's published by Macmillan, St. Martin's Press. St. Martin's Press. That's the American distributor for Macmillan in England. The classic work on this subject in our time, in our century, is C.S. Lewis' book on the miraculous, and the book entitled Miracles, and you certainly ought to be acquainted with that. That is a fine work, and another good work on the subject is Ian Ramsey, Ian Ramsey's little essay on the miraculous. Let me give you another couple of illustrations on this that you will consider fun, I should imagine. One of them I've developed in connection with Gulliver's Travels. We have Gulliver arriving on the island of Lilliput. He wakes up and he's being tied down by little creatures only 6 inches high. Now, Gulliver has had a uniform experience against anybody being shorter than 3.5 feet. This is uniform. Nobody shorter than 3.5 feet. Now, the Lilliputians are tying him down, running up and down on his chest, playing tip-tat-toe and cribbage. They are sitting down and having picnics on his stomach. They are pulling out locks of his hair to keep in their hope chests and so forth. But nothing that they do can have any empirical significance for Gulliver, because as an 18th century Humean, we'll say, he is convinced that there is firm and unalterable experience against these little creatures. So there's nothing they can do. They say to him, see, here we are. Gulliver says, nonsense. You aren't there at all. And they say, what can we do to show you we're really there? And they go, bing, on his nose and so forth. And he says, you might as well stop all that nonsense, because empirical investigation is irrelevant under these circumstances. There is firm and unalterable experience against y'all. He's from southern England, you see. The result of this, of course, would be absurd. The investigation has got to determine the situation. It's like that old farmer who went to the zoo, and he had never seen a giraffe before. And he got up to the cage, and there was the giraffe. And he looked, and he said, "There ain't no such animal." Why? Because it was outside of his experience. Being outside of his experience, he had two choices, either to expand the definition of his experience or to deny that the giraffe was there regardless of evidence. And my farmer denies the existence of the giraffe because he would rather deny reality than alter his worldview. And that's the question before the non-Christian. Is he willing to be honest in the face of data? Is he willing to allow this data to have the same, these data to have the same effect on him as other data do that go against his standard experience? If he's willing to accept new data such as the fluorides of xenon and radon, but is unwilling to face the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus Christ, why is this? It surely isn't in the nature of the evidence. Evidently, the reason for it is that it would involve a moral change if he had to come to terms with Jesus Christ. If you can help him to see that that's what's happening in the situation, you are bringing him to the cross so that he can see that he's got to make a moral decision relative to Jesus, and he can't rationalize his way out of it on the basis of miracles allegedly not occurring. This is an analogy that C.S. Lewis used. He points out the difference between antecedent probability and subsequent probability. He says, you can't use probabilities subsequent to an event. You can only use probabilities antecedent to an event. And he uses this illustration. I will jazz this up slightly for our American scene. You have a bird flying along with a pebble in its beak. We will say that you are a member of the local bird watchers guild and that you would like to find out where the pebble falls. So you jump in, you jump onto your Suzuki, and you head out like blue blazes following the bird. You are observing the bird with one eye and trying to observe the traffic with another eye, and the bird goes along. Now, let us say that before you leave on the motorcycle, you calculate the probabilities against the stone falling in a particular 1 foot square, anywhere in the area of the bird's possible flight pattern. All right? Now, if you do this, you will discover that the probabilities are simply staggering, that the stone will not fall in one particular square foot as compared with all the other places that it could conceivably fall. All right. Well, you're on the motorcycle, you're following the bird. Then a thought occurs to you. You watch carefully, and you notice that the bird is beginning to weave a little bit, and suddenly the bird hiccups. And the stone drops out of its mouth and falls. But you notice the approximate fall of this, and after it falls and strikes the ground, you go out with a piece of chalk and you draw a 1 foot square around it. And then you point out the tremendous probabilities against a thing like that ever having happened. You see the illogic of it? Of course you can calculate the probabilities against a particular thing happening like that, but that is irrelevant once it happens. I mean, think of the probabilities against you having come about. You are the product of a particular genetic union, huh? Calculate the probabilities against that. But it's not especially surprising that you're here. I mean, there's no sense in trying to probabilistically calculate away your existence once you've arrived. In other words, people who try to argue against miracles on a probability basis are simply going back and misusing the sort of thing that Hume was doing. You can't calculate the probabilities against factual reality. You've simply got to face it. As someone has said, a giraffe is highly improbable. I mean, to have anything looking like that. But there they are. There they are. And this reminds me, finally, of that sad case of the statistician who drowned wading across a river with an average depth of 3 feet. And at this point, we are open to questions. Would you go to the microphone if you want to ask something fairly involved or something that would require dialogue between us so that I do not find myself repeating questions ad nauseum and ad infinitum? Yes? Yeah, the question is, why does resurrection imply that Jesus is necessarily God when other people were raised from the dead? For example, Lazarus, and we have in the book of Acts instances of apostles raising people from the dead. Strictly speaking, the fact of resurrection doesn't cause us to jump to the conclusion of deity. What we have here is Jesus claimed to be God, and his statement that the evidence of this is that he will rise from the dead, and then he goes ahead and does it. In other words, we are relying on Jesus' own interpretation of why he was able to do it. Why? Well, simply because you assume that the person who is able to do something that you can't is in a better position to explain it than you are. Thus, in the case of Lazarus, we go to that situation and we say, say, Lazarus, how come you are alive again? How come you've been raised from the dead? Pretty clever of you, says Lazarus. Not in the least, my dear fellow. I was stone dead, and Jesus was the one responsible for raising me from the dead. We go to the apostles and we say, say, aren't you guys something? No wonder apostolic succession developed from you. You actually are able to raise people from the dead. And they say, don't worship us. Remember that situation in Ephesus? Don't worship us. This isn't ourselves. It's Jesus who's doing this. In other words, we are going to the situation and trying to get from it the proper interpretation of it. And the interpretation provided consistently in all these instances is that that is Jesus who is doing it. Now you can say, well, couldn't he have been mistaken? Answer, it's possible. Anything is possible but squeezing toothpaste back into a tube. We have established that important philosophical principle earlier. It's possible. But he, explaining it, has something going for him that you don't have or that I don't have, namely that he did it and we haven't. And when a non-Christian says to you, I see no reason to accept Jesus' evidence, explanation of the resurrection, the proper reply is, well, would you please do it and then explain it on a better basis? And if the non-Christian is not especially in a position to do it, then he jolly well better accept the explanation of the one who has done it. It really is presumptive, isn't it, for a person who can't do something to criticize the one who has done it when he gives the explanation. Okay? Next. Yes?
Yeah, I was going to ask a question last.
Yes. This is a question that relates to the problem of evil that we discussed yesterday. And the question is, what about hell? How can that be reconciled with the God of the Bible, with the God of love? How could anybody actually do something so terrible that he would end up eternally separated from God? Yes, this is a question that comes up quite frequently, and there are several things that can be said in relation to it. One of them is a rather hard answer, but I think you should recognize it and you should use it in certain situations, and it's simply this. The person who says it's immoral for God to permit anybody to go to hell evidently has a standard of morality which is so firmly and universally established that he can judge God by it. The question, of course, is how he justifies that standard of morality. we're going to see tomorrow night that unless there's a revelation from God, you can't in principle get an absolute standard of morality. But obviously, the person who raises this objection doesn't have any revelation in his behalf. He is a person who, by definition, rejects Christianity and thus doesn't go along with the biblical testimony. What standard is he actually using to judge God? He's in a position where he cannot provide a standard of sufficient justification to carry out that kind of analysis. But you quickly note that is a hard answer. It happens to be a sound answer, but it's a hard answer since the objection is on a deep emotional level. The deep emotional level is, what a horrendous sort of thing, eternal separation from God, what could possibly justify a thing like this? All right, let's take it more in the tender-minded direction instead of the tough-minded direction. In the first place, and this ties in with what we said last night, hell is not something that God creates. Hell happens to be the eternal consequence of rejecting God. If a person rejects God and persists in this rejection, the result of it is eternal separation from God. Why? Because love can't be forced. To force a person into heaven would go against the very being of God. And thus, the situation here is that there are people who volitionally choose to remain out of fellowship with God. The non-Christian comes back and he says, "Ah, but you mean just because he rejected God in this life, that's tantamount to rejecting him forever?" Answer to this, yes. Because according to the biblical testimony, when a person is confronted with Jesus Christ and has a genuine opportunity to make a decision relative to Jesus Christ, if the person sees what the situation is and then consciously rejects Jesus Christ, he has rejected the maximum good. He has cut himself off from the only eternal positive solution. And thus, he, by committing the worst possible act, ends up with the worst possible consequence. The horror of rejecting God is that it's the worst thing a person can do, and thus the consequences are the greatest. To reject the infinite results in an infinite negativity. C.S. Lewis has developed this in a great deal of detail, and there is a novel of Lewis's which describes hell in the following terms. This is, of course, a parable, but it is a very clear picture of what the Bible talks about. And according to this parable, a train arrives at Hell Station, and people are already arguing in it, and they're arguing as to which of them is really better than the other. Which person is best, and they're beginning to say, those other people over there, we don't like them. All right, the doors open and people pound out of the train, and they first settle in the city right near the train station. But of course, since the essence of sin is self-centeredness, they begin arguing with each other, and they separate in groups and go off to establish separate cities, always saying, we're better than those other people. But this is a continual proliferation because they are never happy with each other. They always consider themselves more important than the other person, so that this is a constant separation and spreading out. And so you see the landscape of hell as close settlements near the train station, and then the towns become smaller in size as you move out toward the lands toward the horizon, and finally, way at the edge of the horizon, you see nothing but little hovels, and in these hovels are lone individuals, and they are cackling with glee, and they are saying, "Well, I showed them. Well, I showed them. Well, I showed them." See? Now, the biblical picture of hell is of people who insist on their own self-importance to the exclusion of everything else. They will not accept salvation from God. They will not accept the importance of anybody else. And this kind of thing continually hardens until finally the person reaches the point where he is his own God totally. And that is hell. Hell, in other words, turns out to be the product and the result of the creature's own insistence on alienating himself from God. That passage I referred to is in The Great Divorce, in Lewis's novel, The Great Divorce. I think that this kind of explanation can be helpful with the tender-minded person who is deeply concerned about this. I've often stressed the verses, how often, says Jesus of Jerusalem, how often I would have gathered you under my wings as a hen gathers her chicks, but you would not. And Jesus weeps in saying this. Now, if that means anything, that means that no person ever goes to hell that can conceivably be saved. God, in his very heart, wants all men to be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth, which of course also is a biblical quotation. And thus, nobody ever goes to hell who doesn't choose this himself and insist upon it. Okay, next. Yes?
Along the same line.
Yeah, the question on the view that there is eventually an annihilation of the wicked, that view is just not able to be sustained by the exegesis of the New Testament. And all I can do here is to refer you to the classical commentators on the New Testament. The passages are so clear in this that it's just not possible to get around it. Incidentally, John Wenham does not believe in the full authority of the New Testament and was involved in a controversy in England in which he defended a loose view on this subject. And thus, we have here a situation in which he just doesn't take all the passages seriously. You know, the Jehovah's Witnesses also maintain this kind of view. And just to show you the extent to which they go in trying to deal with this, there is the passage in the book of Revelation which says that their worm dieth not. And so the Jehovah's Witnesses says, well, yeah, the people are annihilated, but the worms aren't. Well, now, I mean, really, it's perfectly plain that the impact of the passage is that this is an eternal sort of thing. You know, does not die, dies not. It's a horrible sort of thing to contemplate. But, you know, we can't, in the final analysis, stick our heads in the sand and insist on having the universe the way we think it ought to be. We've got one of the marks of maturity is being willing to face facts, no matter how bad they are. And this happens to be a fact that just must be faced. And certainly God faced it, huh? To the extent of the cross. Yes? The question as to how higher criticism develops, is it really a spiritual problem or what? Well, it's interesting to look a bit at the history of this. The earliest of the higher criticism was applied to the early books of the Old Testament. And higher criticism moved from the Old Testament to the New Testament. The earliest evidence of this kind of thing, if we discount Lorenzo Valla at the time of the Renaissance, who may have suggested this sort of thing, it's not absolutely clear, Valla in the 15th century that influenced Erasmus. If we discount that, we come to Jean Astruc, A-S-T-R-U-C, a French physician of the 18th century. And he suggested that the early chapters of Genesis were the product of editing. He suggested that you could identify the difference by the divine names used, because the word Elohim is used for God in Genesis 1, but beginning in Genesis 2:4, you have Yahweh being used for God. All right, this, however, didn't become a regular method until the 19th century, and three German scholars, Graf, Kienen, und Wellhausen, Graf, Kienen, and Wellhausen, were the three who developed the theory, which came to be known as the JEPD theory. It's usually called today just the Wellhausen theory, which is very sad because poor Graf and poor Kienen contributed something, surely. But in any case, the theory developed in the 19th century in conjunction with an evolutionary view of religion. The feeling was that you couldn't have such primitive religious ideas, in quotes, so late as they appear to be in the Old Testament. You see, religion had to evolve like everything else was supposed to be evolving. And therefore, what you wanted to do was to discover the real order of the material of the Bible, so as to begin with blood sacrifice and all of those primitive ideas, and then go on to ethical monotheism and the ideas of the prophets, which were high religious ideas. And so you wanted to be able to arrange the stuff in that order. But you couldn't arrange it in that order with the texts as they stood. So people began looking at this stuff and seeing if perhaps there were sub-documents where you could attribute certain portions of material to the earlier eras and other portions to the later eras. And the thing got going that way. There was also the contributing factor of some conjecture in classical criticism, though the classicists pretty well relied upon more sound methods than this. Then finally, the application of this came to the New Testament in connection with the work of people like Rudolf Bultmann, the Heilsgeschichte view, and I'm sorry, the Formgeschichtliche view, the form critical view. And there's little doubt about the fact that the most significant factor in all of this is the rise of modern secularism. Modern secularism demands a different view of the Bible from the view of the Bible that historic Christianity took. Modern secularism will not face the miraculous claims of the Bible, will not face the notion that the Bible is the product of God's revelatory acts and that these events actually happened. Well, what are you going to do with this stuff when the stuff constantly declares that that's the case? You're forced to a non-rational interpretation of the material in order to be able to get out from under the full impact of it. Thus, New Testament textual criticism, New Testament higher criticism, has as its most important motivating factor a suspicion of the miraculous. One example of this will make it perfectly plain. It is said that the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, though they've got to be early, the higher critics say, they you can't get them later than the papyrus fragments from them, obviously, though they've got to be early, they certainly were written after 70 AD. Why? Because in 70 AD, the city of Jerusalem was destroyed, right? And in the Gospels, Jesus talks about a destruction coming on Jerusalem, and one stone will not be left upon another, it will be a ghastly destruction. All right, 99 and 44 one-hundredths percent of the higher critics insist upon a post-dating of the Gospels after 70. And the reason is simply anti-miraculous bias. Because what they're saying in effect is, Jesus didn't actually predict this. This was the early church reading the prediction back into Jesus' mouth after the destruction had occurred. You see? Of course, this is a spiritual problem. You don't take that kind of an attitude unless there's something the matter with the way you approach Scripture. You're not approaching Scripture humbly if you do it that way, but you could also say that you're not approaching it in a reasonable historical manner, because after all, does anybody know that predictions can't occur? Heavenly days, Nostradamus managed a few outside of Scripture. And even Gene Dixon occasionally hits things right. So, I mean, there's no reason to conclude that you can use that as a dating principle at all. One more question, and that's it for this evening. Yes? If Jesus was the person he said he was, why should we be so impressed with what he did? Well, it seems to me that in apologetics, in the defense of the faith, we only discover that he was the person he said he was by what he did. You see, anybody can make grandiose claims, right? Remember Father Divine in New York? Father Divine said, in case you're wondering who I am, I'm God. And people gave him fur coats and Cadillacs and stuff like that. People have made divine claims on many occasions through history. But it's one thing to make a claim and another thing to deliver the goods. And it's because we see Jesus rise from the dead that we conclude that his claims are not just affirmations but turn out to be realities. And here I conclude with an historical incident which I have used frequently in apologetics and witnessing. This is a true story. This occurred at the time of the French Revolution. As you know, that was the period of deism, attempts to provide substitute religions for Christianity. And a deist, a philosophe, as they were called in France, a philosopher in that specialized sense, by the name of La Revelliere, determined to establish a new religion, and he called it theanthropy, man as godism. And he prepared, doubtless, tracts and booklets and a social program and a liturgy and so on. He made quite an effort to get this going, and it wasn't successful, and he was very discouraged. And he was presenting the problem to other philosophers, and among them, Talleyrand. Talleyrand had a biting wit and was a very, very keen thinker. And after listening to all of this, Talleyrand said, "It seems to me that Jesus Christ, in order to found his religion, died and rose again on the third day. You could at least do that much." Now that keenly indicates the difference between Christian claims and the others. You see, starting religions is easy. But dying again on the and rising again on the third day, that's something else. And let me reiterate again that that's the reason why this is the central Christian apologetic. Focus attention right here. You get everything in one package, because when you provide an apologetic for the resurrection, you're also providing an apologetic directly for the gospel, because the gospel includes the resurrection, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, and that he rose again the third day according to the scriptures. This is an apologetic that has the shortest distance between it and the proclamation. Look at the difference between this sort of thing in that respect and what we were talking about last night. You know, you can argue till the cows come home about contingency and that sort of thing, and when you're all done, you're a million miles from the gospel. The place to start, the place to focus in, is right here on the historical evidence that Jesus was the one he said he was, and that on the basis of the resurrection. And if you do that, you're also performing precisely the apologetic that is the most frequent and intense in the Bible itself. Read the apostolic preaching. Or if you have given up reading the Bible and are in theology, you can read C.H. Dodd's The Apostolic Preaching and Its Development to find out what the book of Acts does say. And either way, you will discover that essential in the apostolic preaching is the evidence for the resurrection. That's presented over and over again as the crucial case for Christianity. So why not make that the center of the Christian apologetic? I think it's very sad that in lots of Christian institutions and Bible schools and that sort of thing, all the time is spent on rationalistic arguments about the existence of God and current philosophical claims of this kind, and very little time is spent directly focusing on the apologetic, which is crucial in Scripture itself and which obviously has the closest relationship to the gospel.